which difference it makes to have a highly competent teacher versus a much less competent one, by looking at the average performance of a given class of students before and just after the entry of a high-value teacher, or after the exit of such a teacher. For example, each cohort of third-grade students in a given school may be getting about the same mediocre scores and achievement tests year after year until the entry of a teacher with a good track record. Perhaps the previous teacher has left because of an illness. If the performance of the third-year classes shows a jump that is sustained as long as that teacher is in place, we can look at the effect of that increase on subsequent academic achievement, college attendance, and adult income. And the effects of teacher competence on all these variables are marked. Such studies count as near experiments because classes prior to the entry of a given teacher are essentially the control group for classes following the entry of the new teacher. Assignment to condition falls short of random, but when teachers' assignments are apparently fortuitous, we have a reasonably good natural experiment. And some of the most important experiments by economists are those on educational interventions carried out by Roland Fryer. He has conducted extremely valuable educational experiments showing, for example, that financial incentives have little effect on the academic achievement of minority students. They also have little effect on teacher performance, except when loss aversion is triggered by giving the incentives at the beginning of the year with the understanding that failure to improve student achievement will result in losing the incentive. This finding, incidentally, is a lovely example of the greater effect of potential loss than of potential gain, discussed in Chapter 5. Pryor has also played a role in the very successful Harlem Children's Zone experiments, which yielded large increases in academic achievement for African-American students. My Tribe 2. I'm afraid I now have to admit that psychologists can be as guilty of misusing MRA as other behavioral scientists. It's common to report the following kind of finding. Employees of companies with generous parental leave benefits are more satisfied with their jobs than employees of companies that don't provide that benefit. This correlation is then buttressed with an MRA showing that the better the leave policy, the more satisfied employees are with their jobs, and that this is still true when you control for size of company, employee salary, ratings of how pleasant coworkers are, ratings of how much the immediate superior is liked, and so forth. There are three problems with this kind of analysis. First, a limited number of variables will have been measured, and if one or more have been poorly measured, or if there are other variables not examined by investigators that are correlated both with generosity of parental leave policy and job satisfaction, it may be those associations that account for job satisfaction, not leave policy. Second, it really makes no sense to pull parental leave policy out of the total picture of the employee's experience with the company. Generosity of the company in that respect is likely to be bound up with all kinds of other positive qualities of the company. Pulling that one thread out of the complicated ball of relationships among variables, then attempting to control for a few out of many variables in that ball, is not likely to protect us from mistakes. Third, these kinds of analyses leave us particularly vulnerable to the halo effect problem discussed in Chapter 3. People who like their jobs also find the restrooms to be cleaner, the employees to be better looking, and the commutes to be less tedious than people who don't much like their jobs. Love is blind, and liking's vision isn't all that much better. These problems are perhaps easier to see in the case of personality research. It can make little sense to single out one aspect of a person's character and assume it's not strongly related to and meshed with other aspects of the person's character. It's common for psychologists to report findings such as self-esteem is correlated with academic performance, controlling for extroversion, measures of self-control, depressive tendencies, and so on. But low self-esteem and other undesirable states, such as depression, are generally found to be correlated. When you're down, you don't think too highly of yourself, and when you think poorly of yourself, that's likely going to pull your mood down. Looking at self-esteem as if it could be pulled out of the relationship to depression is just an artificial thing to do. It's not plausible that there are many people who could say, "I think I'm terrific, too bad I'm so depressed I can hardly see straight," or "I've never been happier, too bad I'm such a jerk." It's possible, maybe, but the odd ring of such sentences reflects the fact that self-esteem and depression are normally tangled up together. They're not a composite whose elements can be separated. Many of my fellow psychologists are going to be distressed by my bottom line here. Such questions as whether academic success is affected by self-esteem controlling for depression, or whether the popularity of fraternity brothers is affected by extroversion controlling for neuroticism, or whether the number of hugs a person receives per day confers resistance to infection, controlling for age, educational attainment, frequency of social interaction, and a dozen other variables, are not answerable by MRA. What nature hath joined together, multiple regression analysis cannot put asunder. No correlation doesn't mean no causation. Correlation doesn't prove causation. But the problem with correlational studies is worse than that. Lack of correlation doesn't prove lack of causation, and this mistake is made possibly as often as the converse error. Does diversity training improve rates of hiring women and minorities? One study examined this question by quizzing human resource managers at 700 U.S. organizations about whether they had diversity training programs and by checking on the firm's minority hiring rates filed with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. As it happens, having diversity training programs was unrelated to the share of white women, and black men in management. The authors concluded that diversity training did not affect minority hiring. But just a moment. Having diversity training versus not having it is a self-selected variable. Some corporations that hire diversity trainers may be less interested in hiring women and minorities than corporations that find more effective ways to increase hiring. In fact, they may simply be using such programs as protective cover for their real hiring policies. Corporations that don't have diversity training may be effective in hiring minorities by techniques such as setting up diversity task forces or, as the U.S. military does, making successful minority advancement a part of the evaluation of superior officers. Proving that diversity training does or doesn't work will require randomized experiments. We have to fight the reflexive conclusion that A can't exert a causal influence on B because there is no correlation between the two. Discrimination. Look at the statistics or bug the conference room. While we're on the topic of discrimination, let me point out that you can't prove whether discrimination is going on in an organization or a society by statistics. You often read about glass ceilings for women in a given field or about disproportionate school suspension of boys or minorities. The intimation, often the direct accusation, is that discrimination is at work. But numbers alone won't tell the story. We don't know that as many women as men have the qualifications or desire to be partners in law firms or high-level executives in corporations. And we have some pretty good reasons to believe that girls and boys are not equally likely to engage in behavior warranting suspension from school. Not so long ago, it was common to attribute women's lower representation in graduate school and faculty rosters to discrimination. And there certainly was discrimination. I know. I was there. I was privy to the conversations the men had about admitting women to grad school or hiring them onto faculties. Go after the guy. Women are too likely to drop out. Bugged conversations would have proved what raw statistics comparing percentage of men and women hired could not. But nowadays, 60% of college graduates are women, and they constitute a majority of law and medical students, as well as graduate students in the humanities, social sciences, and biological sciences. At the University of Michigan, where I teach, 2/3 of the assistant professors hired are women, and they get tenure at the same rate as men. Do these statistics prove discrimination against men? They do not. And I can assure you that bugged conversations, at least at my school, would not support the discrimination idea either. On the contrary, we are so frequently confronted with the prospect of admitting huge majorities of women into our graduate program that we contemplate relaxing admission standards for men, though we've never carried it out in a conscious way, of that I'm sure. The statistics on postgraduate education have not stopped some people from claiming there is still discrimination against women in the physical sciences. One book I read recently claimed that women were locked out of physics. In the absence of evidence other than the purely statistical kind, there can be no justification for that assertion. But we don't have to resort to bugging conference rooms to establish that discrimination exists. Experiments can do the job. Do car salespeople cite higher prices for women and minorities than for white men? Send a white man, a woman, and a minority group member to Mammoth Motors and see what price each gets quoted. The study has been done, and in fact, the white man is quoted the lowest price. Do good-looking people get better breaks in life? Many studies show that to be the case. Clip a picture of an alleged delinquent to a file and see what sentence is recommended by undergraduate judges. If the kid is good-looking, he's seen as likely to become a better citizen in the future and is given a relatively light sentence. If the kid is ugly, throw the book at him. Life is unfair, as John F. Kennedy said, and experiments are the best instrument we have for revealing just how much more unfair it is for some groups of people than for others. Summing up, multiple regression analysis, MRA, examines the association between an independent variable and a dependent variable, controlling for the association between the independent variable and other variables, as well as the association of those other variables with the dependent variable. The method can tell us about causality only if all possible causal influences have been identified and measured reliably and validly. In practice, these conditions are rarely met. The fundamental problem with MRA, as with all correlational methods, is self-selection. The investigator doesn't choose the value for the independent variable for each subject or case. This means that any number of variables correlated with the independent variable of interest have been dragged along with it. In most cases, we will fail to identify all these variables. In the case of behavioral research, it's normally certain that we can't be confident that we've identified all the plausibly relevant variables. Despite those facts, MRA has many uses. Sometimes it's impossible to manipulate the independent variable. You can't change someone's age. Even when we have an experiment, it adds to our confidence to know that the experimentally demonstrated relationship holds in a natural ecology. An MRA is in general vastly cheaper than experiments, and it can identify relationships that would be important to examine experimentally. When a competently conducted experiment tells you one thing about a given relationship, an MRA tells you another, you normally must believe the experiment. Of course, a badly conducted experiment tells you no more than MRA, sometimes less. A basic problem with MRA is that it typically assumes that the independent variables can be regarded as building blocks, with each variable taken by itself being logically independent of all the others. This is usually not the case, at least for behavioral data. Self-esteem and depression are intrinsically bound up with each other. It's entirely artificial to ask whether one of those variables has an effect on a dependent variable independent of the effects of the other variable. Just as correlation doesn't prove causation, absence of correlation fails to prove absence of causation. False negative findings can occur using MRA just as false positive findings do, because of the hidden web of causation that we failed to identify. Chapter 12. Don't ask, can't tell. How many questionnaire and survey results about people's beliefs, values, or behavior will you read during your lifetime in newspapers, magazines, and business reports? Thousands, surely. You may even create some of these surveys yourself in order to get information that is important for your business, school, or charitable organization. Most of us tend to read survey results rather uncritically. Dear, I see in the Times that 56% of Americans favor tax increases for creating more national parks. Ditto for questions we create ourselves and the answers our respondents give us. So far, all the methods I've discussed are applicable to pretty much everything, animal, vegetable, or mineral. We can do A-B testing on rats, learn from natural experiments about factors influencing corn yields, and do multiple regression studies of factors associated with water purity. Now I'd like to look at the methodological difficulties in measuring specifically human variables. Unlike rats, corn, or water, People can tell you in verbal form, oral or written, about their attitudes, emotions, needs, goals, and behavior. And they can tell you what the causal influences on these variables are. In this chapter, you'll see just how misleading such reports can be, which won't be surprising given what you heard in Part 1 about our limited accessibility to the factors that influence our behavior. The chapter will show you how a variety of behavioral measures can provide much more trustworthy answers to questions about people's attributes and states than their verbal reports can. You'll also get some tips about experiments you can do on yourself to learn what kinds of things influence your attitudes, behaviors, and physical and emotional health. Correlational evidence about yourself can be just as misleading as correlational evidence about anything else. Experiments on yourself can produce evidence that is accurate and compelling. Constructing attitudes on the fly. The following examples may make you pause before trusting self-reported verbal answers and may help you consider how best to get useful information about people's attitudes and beliefs. The examples may also increase your doubts about people's explanations of the causal influences on their judgments and behavior. Question. Suppose I ask you about three positive events in your life and then ask you about your life satisfaction. Or I ask you about three negative events and then about your life satisfaction. In which case do you report greater life satisfaction? Answer. Whatever you guessed about the effect of asking about positive versus negative events, I'm sorry to tell you, your answer is wrong. It all depends on whether those events I asked you about were in the recent past or happened 5 or so years ago. Your life seems worse if you've just contemplated some lousy things that have happened lately than if you've contemplated some good things that have happened lately. No surprise there. But the reverse is true if you contemplate events from 5 years ago. Your life seems good compared to the bad things that happened in your past, and your life seems not so great compared to the wonderful things that used to happen. This helps to explain the otherwise puzzling fact that for members of the greatest generation, life satisfaction is greater the worse their experiences during the Depression had been. Question. Your cousin from Omaha calls you and asks you how things are going. Is your answer influenced by whether it's sunny and warm versus cloudy and cold where you are? Answer. Turns out that it depends. If the weather is nice, you're more likely to say things are going well than if the weather is lousy. Well, of course. But if your cousin inquires first about the weather in your city today and then asks you how things are going, there is no effect of the weather on your report of how things are going. Why? Psychologists say that when prompted to think about the weather, we discount some of our mood as being weather-related and add or subtract happiness points accordingly. In effect, life seems to be going pretty well, but probably part of the reason I feel that way is that it's 70 degrees and sunny out, so I guess things are just so-so. Question. What do you suppose is the correlation between satisfaction with one's marriage and satisfaction with one's life as a whole? Answer. This seems like a fairly easy thing to examine. We can ask people about their satisfaction with their lives and then ask them about their satisfaction with their marriages. The higher the correlation between the two, the greater we might assume the impact of marriage satisfaction on life satisfaction to be. That correlation has been examined. The correlation is 0.32, indicating a modestly important effect of marriage satisfaction on life satisfaction as a whole. But suppose we reverse the question order and ask people how satisfied they are with their marriages before we ask how satisfied they are with their lives. Now the correlation is 0.67, indicating a major effect of marriage quality on life quality. So whether Joe tells us that life is good or just all right depends, and depends heavily, on whether you just asked him how good his marriage is. This phenomenon, and many others discussed in this chapter, shows the effects of verbal priming of the type discussed in Chapter 1 on people's reports about their attitudes. Other phenomena show the influence of context of the kind discussed in Chapter 2 on reports about attitudes. The likely reason question order is so important is that asking first about marriage makes it highly salient, so it heavily influences the respondent's feelings about life overall. If you don't ask first about marriage, the respondent considers a broader range of things, and that wider set of influences figures into the assessment of life satisfaction. So just how important really is marriage quality for life quality? There can be no answer to that question. At any rate, not by asking questions of this kind. If the apparent importance of marriage quality for life quality is so malleable, then we've learned little about the reality. But the truth is, the answer to just about every question concerning attitudes and behavior can be pushed around, often by things that seem utterly fortuitous or silly. Suppose I ask you how favorable you are toward politicians. But before I do, I point out that the average rating of politicians given by other people is 5 on a scale of 1 to 6, with higher numbers being more favorable. Or I point out that the average rating of politicians is 2 on that scale. You will rate politicians higher in the first case than in the second. Some of that is due to sheer conformity. You don't want to seem an oddball. But more interesting, announcing others' ratings tacitly changes not just your judgment of politicians, but your assumptions about the kind of politicians I'm asking about. If I tell you most people have a high opinion of politicians, I've implied that by politicians I mean statesmen on the order of Churchill or Roosevelt. If I tell you that most people have a low opinion of politicians, I have tacitly implied that by politicians I mean hacks and chiselers. I've literally changed what it is you're making your judgment about. What percent of Americans are in favor of the death penalty? In the abstract, a majority. For any given case, a minority. The more details we present about the crime, the criminal, and the circumstances, the less inclined respondents are to be willing to execute the perpetrator. Remarkably, that's true even for the most heinous of crimes, such as a criminal who rapes women and then kills them. The more details you give about the perpetrator's character and life history, the more reluctant people are to favor the death penalty. This is true even when that information is overwhelmingly negative. What percent of Americans support abortion? Here I close the blinds and ask, sotto voce, what do you want it to be? According to a 2009 Gallup poll, 42% of Americans say they are pro-choice as opposed to pro-life. So 42% of Americans support abortion. But according to another Gallup poll the same year, 23% believe that abortion should be legal in all circumstances, and 53% believe that abortion should be legal under certain circumstances. So 76% of Americans support abortion. I have no doubt that we could get that percentage higher still if we asked whether the respondent favors abortion in the case of rape, in the case of incest, or in order to save the life of the mother. If the respondent replies yes to any of those questions, we can record the respondent as favoring abortion. So whether less than half the population supports abortion or a heavy majority supports it is entirely a matter of question wording. A host of studies by psychologists show that people don't carry all their attitudes around with them in a mental file folder. How do I feel about abortion? I'll check. Let's see, abortion attitudes toward. Ah, yes, here I have it. I'm moderately opposed. Instead, many attitudes are extremely context-dependent and constructed on the fly. Change the context, and you change the expressed attitude. Sadly, even trivial-seeming circumstances such as question wording, the type and number of answer categories used, and the nature of the preceding questions are among the contextual factors that can profoundly affect people's reports of their opinions. Even reports about attitudes of high personal or social importance can be quite mutable. What makes you happy? Verbal reports about attitudes are susceptible to a host of other methodological problems. People lie about some things, sex, money. People want to look good in their own eyes and in the eyes of others. This social desirability bias often causes people to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative. But lies and trying to look good are really the least of our problems in finding out the truth about people's attitudes and behavior and why they believe what they believe and do what they do. At least we're pretty good at knowing what makes us happy or unhappy. Or are we? Rank the following factors in order of the degree to which they seem to influence your mood on a given day. Let's see how accurately you can assess what causes your mood to fluctuate. Rate the importance of the following items on a scale of 1, very little, to 5, a great deal. 1. How well your work went. 2. Amount of sleep you got the preceding night. 3. How good your health is. 4. How good the weather is. 5. Whether you had sexual activity. 6. Day of the week. 7. If you are a woman, stage of the menstrual cycle. No matter what you said, there's no reason to believe it's accurate. At any rate, we know that's the case for Harvard women. Psychologists asked students to report at the end of each day for 2 months the quality of their mood. Respondents also reported the day of the week, the amount of sleep they had the night before, what their health status was, whether they had had any sexual activity, what stage of the menstrual cycle they were in, and so forth. At the end of the 2 months, participants were asked how each of the factors tended to affect their mood. The participants' answers to these questions made it possible to find out 2 things. 1, how much participants thought each factor affected their mood, and 2, how well each factor actually predicted their mood. Did these self-reports reflect the actual correlations between reported factors and reported moods? As it turned out, participants were not accurate at all. There was 0 correlation between a factor's actual effect on mood, based on the daily ratings, and participants' beliefs about the degree to which variations in the factor influenced variations in mood. Literally no correspondence at all. If the woman said day of the week was very important, the actual association between day of the week and mood was as likely to be low as high. If the woman said sexual activity was not very important, the actual correlation between sexual activity and mood was as likely to be high as low. There was an even more embarrassing finding. Embarrassing to the participants, but also to everybody else, since there's no reason to assume Harvard women are uniquely lacking in insight into the causes of their mood. Jane's self-reports about the relative influence of the factors affecting her mood were no more accurate than her guesses about the effects of those factors on a typical Harvard woman's mood. In fact, her guesses about the typical student were pretty much the same as her guesses about herself. Clearly, we have theories about what affects our moods. Goodness knows where we get them all. When asked how various things affect our mood, we consult these theories. We are unable to access the facts, even though it feels as though we can. I'm tempted to say we don't know what makes us happy. That goes too far, of course. What we can say is that our beliefs about the relative importance of different events affecting our well-being are poorly calibrated with their actual importance. Of course, there's nothing unique about the factors affecting mood. As you heard in Chapter 8 on correlations, detecting correlations of any kind is not one of our strong suits. The lesson of the Harvard study is a general one. Psychologists find that our reports about the causes of our emotions, attitudes, and behavior can be quite untrustworthy, as was first shown in Part 1. The relativity of attitudes and beliefs. First man, how's your wife? Second man, compared to what? Old vaudeville routine. Test the validity of your opinions about ethnic and national differences by answering the following questions. Who values being able to choose personal goals more, Chinese or Americans? Who are more conscientious, Japanese or Italians? Who are more agreeable, Israelis or Argentinians? Who are more extroverted, Austrians or Brazilians? I'm betting you didn't guess that Chinese value choosing their own goals more than Americans, or that Italians are more conscientious than the Japanese, the Israelis more agreeable than the Argentinians, or the Austrians more extroverted than the Brazilians. How do we know these differences exist? People from those countries tell us so themselves. How could people's beliefs about their values and personalities differ so much from popular opinion? And, for that matter, from the opinions of academic experts who are highly familiar with each of these cultural pairs. People's answers about their own values, traits, and attitudes are susceptible to a large number of artifacts. The word artifact has 2 dimly related meanings. In archaeology, the word refers to an object created by humans, for example, a piece of pottery. In scientific methodology, the word refers to a finding that is erroneous due to some unintended measurement error, often due to intrusive human action. In the case of cultural comparisons, the discrepancy between people's self-reports about their characteristics and our beliefs about the characteristics of people of their nationality is due to the reference group effect. When you ask about my values, my personality, or my attitudes, I base my answer in part on a tacit comparison with some group that is salient to me, for example, because I'm a member of it. So an American, asked how important it is to be able to choose her own goals, implicitly compares herself to other Americans, and perhaps to other Jewish Americans, and perhaps to other Jewish American females in her college. So compared to other Americans, or Jews, or Jewish females at Ohio State, choosing her own goals doesn't seem like all that big a deal to her. The Chinese respondent is comparing himself to other Chinese, or other Chinese males, or other Chinese males at Beijing Normal University. And it may seem to him that he cares more about choosing his own goals than do most people in his reference group. One reason we know that tacit comparison with a reference group is a big factor in producing these self-reports, Austrians more extroverted than Brazilians, etc., is that they disappear when you make the reference group explicit. European Americans at Berkeley rate themselves as more conscientious than do Asian Americans at Berkeley, but not when you have both groups compare themselves to the explicit reference group of typical Asian American Berkeley students. Other things being equal, people in most cultures believe they are superior to most others in their group. This self-enhancement bias is sometimes known as the Lake Wobegon effect, after Garrison Keillor's mythical town where all the children are above average. 70% of American college students rate themselves as above average in leadership ability, and only 2% rate themselves below average. Virtually everyone self-rates as above average in ability to get along with others. In fact, 60% say they are in the top 10%, and 25% say they are in the top 1%. Degree of self-enhancement bias differs substantially across cultures and across subgroups within a given culture. No one seems to top Americans in this respect, whereas East Asians often show a contrary effect, namely a modesty bias. So any self-assertions concerning issues having a value component, leadership, ability to get along with others, will find Westerners rating themselves higher than East Asians do. Americans will rate themselves as better leaders than Koreans do, and Italians will rate themselves as more conscientious than Japanese do. Many other artifacts find their way into self-reports. These include what's called acquiescence response set or agreement response bias. This is the tendency to say yes to everything. As you might expect, yay-saying is more common among polite East Asians and Latin Americans than it is among frank Europeans and European Americans. There are also individual differences within a culture in tendency to agree. Fortunately, there's a way to counteract this. Investigators can counterbalance response categories so that half the time, respondents get a high score on some dimension, extroversion versus introversion, for example, by agreeing with a statement, and half the time by disagreeing with a statement. I like to go to large parties versus I don't like to go to large parties. This cancels out any bias to agree with statements in general. The counterbalancing correction is well known to all social scientists, but is surprisingly often neglected by them. Talking the talk versus walking the walk. But is there a better way to compare people, groups, and whole cultures than just by asking them? You bet there is. Behavioral measures, especially those taken when people don't realize they're being observed, are much less susceptible to artifacts of all kinds. Rather than ask people how conscientious they are, you can measure how conscientious they are by examining their grades, or better, their grades controlling for their cognitive ability scores, the neatness of their rooms, how likely they are to be on time for an appointment or a class, and so on. We can also examine the conscientiousness of whole cultures by measuring such proxies for conscientiousness as speed of postal delivery, accuracy of clocks, on-time record of trains and buses, longevity, and number of questions people answer on a lengthy and boring questionnaire. Incidentally, the correlation between the math scores of different nations and the number of tedious questions they answer on an interminable questionnaire is extremely high. Remarkably, it turns out that when we examine behavior to find out how conscientious people of different countries are, we find that the less conscientious a nation is, as measured by behavioral indices, the more conscientious its citizens are as measured by self-report. When it comes to the measurement of virtually any psychological variable, I follow the maxim that you should trust behavior, including physiological behavior such as heart rate, cortisol output, and the activity of different brain regions, more than responses to concrete scenarios. Descriptions of situations followed by measures of expected or preferred outcomes or behaviors by the self or others. In turn, you should trust scenario responses more than verbal reports about beliefs, attitudes, values, or traits. I wouldn't wish to have you doubt every verbal report you see in the media or doubt your own ability to construct a questionnaire of any kind. If you want to find out whether your employees would rather have the picnic on a Saturday or a Sunday, you don't have to worry much about their answers being valid. But even for expressions of preference, you can't necessarily trust self-reports. As Steve Jobs said, "It's not the customer's job to know what they want." Henry Ford remarked that if he had asked people what they wanted in the way of transportation, they would have said, "Faster horses." And realtors have an expression, "Buyers are liars." The client who assures you she must have a ranch house falls in love with a 1920s Tudor. The client who pines after a modern steel and glass edifice ends up with a faux adobe house. Finding out people's preferences is a tricky matter for businesses. Even the best thought-out focus group can come a cropper. Henry's successors at Ford Motor Company had a fondness for focus groups, in which a group of people are quizzed by corporate representatives and by each other. The organizers use the expressed preferences to establish what new goods or services would be likely to succeed. Automotive legend has it that in the mid-1950s, Ford had the idea of removing the center post from a four-door sedan to see whether its sporty appearance would appeal to buyers. The people they gathered for the focus groups thought the idea was a bad one. "Why, it hasn't got a center post. It looks weird. I don't think it would be safe." General Motors skipped the focus groups and went straight into production with a center post-free Oldsmobile, calling it a four-door hardtop convertible. It was a huge success. The hardtop experience apparently didn't cause Ford to rethink how much attention they should pay to focus groups. The company doubled down on them in making their decision to market the 1950s Edsel, the very icon of product failure. The take-home lesson of this section: whenever possible, don't listen too much to people talk the talk. Watch them walk the walk. More generally, the chapters in this section constitute a sermon about the need to get the best possible measures of any variable that we care about and find the best possible means to test how it's related to other variables. In the great chain of investigation strategies, true experiments beat natural experiments, which beat correlational studies, including multiple regression analyses, which any day beat assumptions and man-who statistics. Failure to use the best available scientific methodology can have big costs for individuals, for institutions, and for nations. Experiments on yourself. As shown by the Harvard study of women asked to assess factors influencing their moods, we are in as much trouble detecting correlations in our own lives as in other areas. Fortunately, we can do experiments with ourselves as the subject and get better information about what makes us tick. What factors make it difficult to fall asleep? Is coffee in the morning helpful for efficiency during the day? Do you get more useful work done in the afternoon if you take a cat nap after lunch? Are you more effective if you skip lunch? Does yoga improve well-being? Does the Buddhist practice of loving kindness, visualizing smiling at others, reflecting on their positive qualities and their acts of generosity, and repeating the words loving kindness, bring you peace and relieve you of anger toward others? A problem with experiments on the self is that you're dealing with an N of one. An advantage, however, is that experiments on the self automatically have a within before after design, which can improve accuracy because of the reduction in error variance. You can also keep confounding variables to a minimum. If you're looking to discover the effect of some factor on you, try to keep everything else constant across the study period when you're comparing presence of the factor versus absence of the factor. That way you can have a fairly good experiment. Don't take up yoga at the same time as you move from one house to another or break up with your boyfriend. Arrange to start yoga when a proper before-after design is possible. Monitor your physical and emotional well-being the quality of your relations with others, and your effectiveness at work for a few weeks before taking up yoga, and use the same measures for a few weeks after taking it up. Simple 3-point scales provide adequate measures of these things. At the end of the day, rate your well-being. 1, not great. 2, okay. 3, very good. Get the mean on each variable for the days before taking up yoga and for the days after, and hope nothing big happens in your life to muddy the waters. Often you can do better than the before-after study. You can take advantage of random assignment to condition. If you try to figure out whether coffee in the morning improves your efficiency, don't just drink coffee haphazardly. If you do, any number of confounding variables can distort the test results. If you drink coffee only when you feel particularly groggy in the morning, or only on a day when you have to be at the top of your form at work, your data are going to be a mess, and any lesson you'll think you've learned will likely be off the mark. Literally, flip a coin as you walk into the kitchen. Heads you have coffee, tails you don't. Then keep track, in writing, of your efficiency during the day. Use a 3-point scale. Not very efficient, fairly efficient, very efficient. Then after a couple of weeks, do a tally. Calculate the mean effectiveness on days with and without coffee. The same experimental procedure works for any number of things that are candidates for influencing your well-being or effectiveness. And don't kid yourself that you can figure these things out without being systematic about random assignment to condition and rigorously keeping track with decent measures of outcomes. It's eminently worth doing experiments like this because there are actually big individual differences in things such as the effects of coffee, the degree of benefit from both endurance training and weight training, and whether peak work efficiency is in the morning, afternoon, or evening. What works for Jill or Joe may not work for you. Summing up, verbal reports are susceptible to a huge range of distortions and errors. We have no file drawer in our heads out of which to pull attitudes. Attitude reports are influenced by question wording, by previously asked questions, by priming with incidental situation stimuli present at the time the question is asked. Attitudes, in other words, are often constructed on the fly and subject to any number of extraneous influences. Answers to questions about attitudes are frequently based on tacit comparison with some reference group. If you ask me how conscientious I am, I will tell you how conscientious I am compared to other absent-minded professors, my wife, or members of some group who happen to be salient because they were around when you asked me the question. Reports about the causes of our behavior, as you learned in Chapter 3 and were reminded of in this chapter, are susceptible to a host of errors and incidental influences. They're frequently best regarded as readouts of theory, innocent of any facts uncovered by introspection. Actions speak louder than words. Behavior is a better guide to understanding people's attitudes and personalities than our verbal responses. Conduct experiments on yourself. The same methodologies that psychologists use to study people can be used to study yourself. Casual conversation can mislead about what kinds of things influence a given outcome. Deliberate manipulation of something, with condition decided upon randomly, plus systematic recording, can tell you things about yourself with an accuracy unobtainable by simply living your life and casually observing its circumstances. Part 5. Thinking, Straight and Curved. People have discovered many different ways to reduce the likelihood of making an error in reasoning. One way is to obey the rules of formal logic, rules for reasoning that can be described in purely abstract terms without making any contact at all with real-world facts. If the structure of your argument can be mapped directly onto one of the valid forms of argument that logic specifies, you're guaranteed a deductively valid conclusion. Whether your conclusion is true is a different matter entirely and depends on the truth of your premises, the statements that precede your conclusion. Formal logic is a type of deductive reasoning, top-down argument forms that produce conclusions that follow necessarily from the premises on which they are based. Two kinds of formal logic have received a great deal of attention historically. The oldest is the syllogism. Syllogisms are used for some kinds of categorical reasoning. For example, all A are B, X is an A, therefore X is a B. Most famously, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Syllogisms have been around for at least 2,600 years. Formal logic also includes propositional logic, which is somewhat more recent, having first been treated seriously by 4th century BC Greek Stoic philosophers. This kind of logic tells us how to reach valid conclusions from premises, such as with the logic of the conditional. For example, if P is the case, then Q is the case. P is the case, therefore Q is the case. If it snows, the schools will be closed. It snowed, therefore the schools will be closed. P is a condition requiring Q, or differently put, P is a sufficient condition for Q. In contrast to deductive logic, inductive reasoning is a bottom-up type of reasoning. Observations are collected that suggest or support some conclusion. One type of inductive reasoning consists of observing facts and reaching a general conclusion about facts of their particular kind. This book is full of different types of inductive reasoning. The scientific method nearly always involves, in fact often is completely dependent on, inductive reasoning of one kind or another. All of the types of inductive reasoning in this book are inductively valid, but their conclusions are not deductively valid, merely probable. On the basis of observation and calculation, we induce that the mean of the population of some events is X plus or minus Y standard deviations. Or we induce from observing the results of our experiment that A causes B, since we observe that every time A is the case, B is also the case. When A is not the case, B is not the case. It's more probable that A causes B, if these things are true, than if we're missing those observations. But it's not certain that A causes B. For example, something associated with A might be causing B. Inductive conclusions aren't guaranteed to be true, even if all the observations they are based on are true. There are many of them, and there are no exceptions. The generalization, all swans are white, is inductively valid, but as it turns out, not true. Deductive and inductive reasoning schemas essentially regulate inferences. They tell us what kinds of inferences are valid and what kinds are invalid. A very different kind of system of reasoning, also developed about 2,600 years ago in Greece and developed at the same time in India, is called dialectical reasoning. This form of reasoning doesn't so much regulate reasoning as suggest ways to solve problems. Dialectical reasoning includes the Socratic dialogue, which is essentially a conversation or debate between two people trying to reach the truth by stimulating critical thinking, clarifying ideas, and discovering contradictions that may prompt the discussants to develop views that are more coherent and more likely to be correct or useful. 18th and 19th century versions of dialectical reasoning, owing primarily to the philosophers Hegel, Kant, and Fichte, center on the process of thesis followed by antithesis followed by synthesis. A proposition followed by a potential contradiction of that proposition followed by a synthesis that resolves any contradiction. Other types of reasoning that have been labeled dialectical were developed in China, also beginning around 2,600 years ago. Chinese dialectical reasoning deals with a much broader range of issues than Western or Indian versions of dialectical reasoning. The Chinese version suggests ways of dealing with contradiction, conflict, change, and uncertainty. For example, whereas the Hegelian dialectic is aggressive in the face of contradiction, in the sense that it seeks to obliterate contradictions between propositions in favor of some new proposition, Chinese dialectical reasoning often seeks to find ways in which the conflicting propositions can both be true. Dialectical reasoning isn't formal or deductive and usually doesn't deal in abstractions. It's concerned with reaching true and useful conclusions rather than valid conclusions. In fact, conclusions based on dialectical reasoning can actually be opposed to those based on formal logic. Relatively recently, psychologists both in the East and in the West have begun to study dialectical reasoning, developing systematic descriptions of prior formulations and proposing new dialectical principles. Chapter 13 presents two common types of formal reasoning And chapter 14 presents an introduction to some forms of dialectical reasoning that I find most interesting and helpful. All of the scientific tools discussed in this book depend to some degree on formal logic. Many of the other tools appeal to dialectical precepts. Chapter 13. Logic. Imagine four cards spread out on a surface. They're randomly chosen from a deck of cards in which every card has a letter on one side and a number on the other. Card 1 shows the letter N, card 2 shows a 4, card 3 shows an A, card 4 shows a 3. Please indicate which of the cards you would have to turn over in order to find out whether the card obeys this rule. If a card has a vowel on one side, then it has an even number on the other side. Turn over only those cards that are necessary to establish that the rule is being followed. Commit yourself. I must turn over A, card 3 only, B, cards 1, 2, 3, and 4, C, cards 3 and 4, D, cards 1, 3, and 4, E, cards 1 and 3. We'll return to this problem later in a different context. Critical reasoning texts usually have a heavy dose of formal deductive logic. This is done more because of ancient pedagogical tradition than because of any evidence of utility for everyday thought. And in fact, there are some reasons to suspect that most of what you hear in this chapter on formal logic will be of limited value in solving problems in everyday life. But there are nevertheless some good reasons to read about formal logic. 1. Formal logic is essential for science and mathematics. 2. The chapter sets up the stark contrast that exists between Western hyper-rationality and Eastern dialectical habits of thought. The two systems of thought can both be applied to the same problem, generating different conclusions. The two systems also provide excellent platforms for critiquing each other. 3. An educated person should have some command over basic forms of logical reasoning. 4. Formal logic is interesting, at least to lots of people, at any rate in doses about the size of this chapter. The story about the Western origins of formal logic goes as follows. Aristotle got tired of hearing lousy arguments in the marketplace and the assembly, so he decided to develop reasoning templates to apply to arguments in order to analyze them for validity. An argument is valid if and only if its conclusions follow necessarily from its premises. Validity has nothing to do with truth. An argument can be invalid, but its conclusion can be true. An argument is valid if it has the proper structure, but its conclusion can nevertheless be false. The concept of argument validity is important for many reasons. One reason is that you don't want to allow someone to trick you, or allow you to trick yourself, by conferring plausibility on a conclusion because it follows from some premises, unless those premises are true and the conclusion follows necessarily from the premises. A second reason is that we don't want to allow ourselves to disbelieve conclusions that we happen to dislike if the premises are clearly true and the form of the argument dictates that the conclusion must be true as well. A third reason is that if we have a clear grasp of the concept of validity as opposed to truth, we can assess whether a conclusion follows from its premises by stripping away the meaning from the premises and the conclusion and thinking purely in terms of abstractions, A's and B's rather than birds and bees. That can show us that a conclusion at least follows from its premises. So even though the conclusion is highly implausible, it's at least not the product of illogical reasoning. Syllogisms. One of Aristotle's major contributions to formal logic was the syllogism. The creation of syllogisms ballooned into a cottage industry in the Middle Ages when monks generated dozens of them. From the Middle Ages until the late 19th century, philosophers and educators believed that syllogisms provided powerful rules for thought. Consequently, they formed a large part of the curriculum in higher education in the West. The issue of validity arises for syllogisms, which deal with categorical reasoning. Some kinds of categorical reasoning involve the quantifiers all, some, and none. The simplest syllogisms involve two premises and one conclusion. The simplest of those simple syllogisms, and one that we're not normally at risk of getting wrong, is all A are B, all B are C, all A are C. The classic here is all clerks are human, all humans are bipedal, all clerks are bipedal. That argument is valid because it follows logically from the premises. The conclusion is also true. All clerks are human, all humans have feathers, all clerks have feathers. That argument is valid too, though the conclusion is untrue. But the implausibility of the conclusion draws us toward feeling that the argument is also invalid. Substituting A's, B's, and C's for clerks, humans, and feathers allows us to see the validity of the argument. That may force us to reconsider whether a conclusion is true, which can be useful. The next argument is invalid, even though its premises and its conclusion are all true, or at least highly plausible. All people on welfare are poor. Some poor people are dishonest. Therefore, some people on welfare are dishonest. In abstract terms, all A are B, some B are C, therefore some A are C. The exercise of abstracting the terms is useful because we may have the feeling that a conclusion is true because it seems plausible and because we have true premises that seem to support it logically. Finding that an argument is invalid strips away the feeling that the conclusion is necessarily true and may cause us to doubt it. The key to recognizing the invalidity of the last argument is to realize that the A's are a subset of the B's. Things rapidly become more complicated from here. All A are B, some C are A, some C are B. Valid or not? No A are B, some C are B, no A are C. Valid or not? You can spin these out till the cows come home. Medieval monks whiled away the weary hours by generating endless numbers of them. But I agree with the philosopher Bertrand Russell, who said that the syllogisms were as sterile as the monks. So much for 2,600 years of pedagogy that assumed that syllogisms were crucial for effective thinking. The most useful thing I've gained from instruction in categorical reasoning is learning how to draw Venn diagrams, named for the 19th century logician John Venn, who invented a pictorial way of representing category membership. Every now and then I find these useful, even necessary, for representing relationships between categories. One Venn diagram shows two intersecting circles marked A and B. It captures a particular syllogism that we do use in everyday life. It represents a situation in which some, but not all, A are B, and some, but not all, B are A. A might stand for small furry animals, and B might stand for duck-billed. As it happens, there is one animal in the intersection of A and B, namely a duck-billed platypus. Or it could represent a situation in which some but not all of the students who are English speakers at an international school also speak French, and some but not all French speakers speak English. Some but not all A are B, and some but not all B are A. The exclusive English speakers, A only, must study mathematics with Ms. Smith. The exclusive French speakers, B, must study with Monsieur Pirot. Students who speak both languages can study with either teacher. Another Venn diagram shows three intersecting circles marked A, B, and C. It shows the much more complicated but not rare situation in which some A are B, some B are A, some A are C, some C are A, some B are C, and some C are B. Another Venn diagram presents an actual example of that situation. It represents the intersections of letters that are found in Greek, the A circle, Latin, the B circle, and Russian, the C circle. I defy you to reach the correct conclusion about overlap of categories solely by means of verbal propositions about categories. In any case, I'm sure I would end up merely with alphabet soup. This is not enough on Venn diagrams to set you up for a very wide range of problems, but it gives you some of the basics on how to represent category inclusions and exclusions pictorially. You might find that learning more about Venn diagrams will be useful for you. Propositional logic. Syllogisms apply only to a tiny range of inferences that we need to make in everyday life. Much more important is propositional logic, which applies to an enormous range of inferential problems. Philosophers and logicians made sporadic contributions to propositional logic between roughly 300 BC and AD 1300. Beginning in the mid-19th century, logicians started to make considerable progress on propositional logic, in particular focusing on operators such as and or. And is concerned with conjunctions, such as A is the case and B is the case, therefore A and B are both the case. Or is concerned with disjunctions, such as A is the case or B is the case. A is the case, therefore B is not the case. Work on propositional logic in that era became the basis for computer design and programming. At the beginning of the chapter, I asked you to solve a problem about cards. You can now see it was a problem requiring the application of conditional logic. If P, then Q. If a card has a vowel on one side, then it has an even number on the other side. Before we see how well you did on the problem, let's see how you do on the following problem. You're a police inspector. One of your tasks is to make sure that restaurants don't sell alcohol to anyone under 21. Your task is to say which of the customers you have to check in order to see whether the customer is obeying this rule. If a customer is drinking alcohol, the customer is at least 21. You should check only those customers necessary to establish that the rule is being followed. The first table you see has four customers. You see that customer 1 looks to be over 50, customer 2 isn't drinking anything, customer 3 is drinking beer, customer 4 looks to be under 21. You need to check A, customer 1, B, customers 1, 2, 3, and 4, C, customers 3 and 4, D, customers 1, 3, and 4, E, customers 1 and 3. I'm betting that you said option C, customers 3 and 4. Now, think back to the card problem. I'm betting that you didn't say option C, cards 3 and 4. Can we agree that you should have? The logical structure of the two problems is identical. Check my logic. Card problem. Make sure this rule is not violated. Vowel? Better be an even number on the other side. N, doesn't matter whether there's an even number on the back or not. 4, doesn't matter whether there's a vowel on the other side or not. A, better be an even number on the other side, if not the rule is broken. 3, better not be a vowel on the other side, if so, the rule is broken. Restaurant problem. Make sure this rule is not violated. Drinking, better be 21. Customer is 50 plus. Doesn't matter whether customer is drinking or not. Isn't drinking. Doesn't matter whether customer is 21 or not. Drinking. Better be 21. If not, the rule is broken. Under 21. Better not be drinking. If so, the rule is broken. Don't feel bad if you didn't get the card problem right. Less than 20% of Oxford University students can solve the abstract version of the card problem. Why is the card problem so much harder than the restaurant problem? At first blush, this seems strange, because both problems can be solved by applying conditional logic. In fact, by applying the very simplest principle of conditional logic, modus ponens. If P is the case, then Q is the case. If the customer is drinking, then the customer is 21. P is in fact the case, the customer is drinking, therefore Q is the case, therefore the customer is 21. Modus ponens entails modus tollens. If not Q, then not P. An instance where Q, 21 or over, is not the case, but P, drinking, is the case, contradicts the conditional rule. Note that P, drinking, is a sufficient condition but not a necessary condition for Q. It's sufficient that P is the case in order for Q to be the case. Lots of other conditions might be sufficient to require that the person is 21. Flying a plane, for example, or gambling. For the biconditional, P is both necessary and sufficient in order for Q to be the case. This would include the rather weird rule that if you're drinking, you must be 21, and if you're 21, you must be drinking. After some more consideration of conditional reasoning, we'll discuss why the drinking problem is so easy. Plausibility, validity, and the logic of the conditional. As we've seen, syllogistic arguments can be valid, that is, map correctly onto a cogent argument form, even when their conclusions aren't true. That's true as well for propositional logic. Decide whether each of the following arguments, having two premises and one conclusion, is valid. Argument A. Premise 1. If he died of cancer, he had a malignant tumor. Premise 2. He had a malignant tumor. Conclusion. Therefore, he died of cancer. Argument B. Premise 1. If he died of cancer, he had a malignant tumor. Premise 2. He didn't die of cancer. Conclusion. Therefore, he didn't have a malignant tumor. Argument C. Premise 1. If he died of cancer, he had a malignant tumor. Premise 2. He died of cancer. Conclusion. Therefore, he had a malignant tumor. Only argument C is valid. It maps onto modus ponens. If P, he died of cancer, then Q, tumor. P, cancer, therefore Q, tumor. The plausibility of the conclusions in arguments A and B tempts us into feeling that they're valid. But argument A maps onto an invalid argument form. If P died of cancer, then Q, tumor. Q, tumor, therefore P died of cancer. This is called the converse error because the form of reasoning involves erroneously converting the premise, if P then Q, into if Q then P. If he had a malignant tumor, then he died of cancer. If that had been the premise, then we would indeed know that since Q is the case, P is also the case. But that wasn't the premise. We make converse errors all the time if we're not monitoring ourselves for the logical validity of our argument. Converse error 1. If the car is not in our garage, then Jane went downtown. Jennifer told me she saw Jane downtown, therefore the car won't be in the garage. But of course Jane could have gotten downtown by some means other than taking the car, in which case the car probably will be in the garage. Making the error is more likely given some kinds of background knowledge. If Jane rarely goes anywhere without the car, we're more likely to make the error. If she sometimes takes the bus and sometimes is driven by a friend, we're less likely to make the error. Converse error 2. If I have the flu, then I have a sore throat. I have a sore throat. Therefore, I have the flu. Background knowledge. If Jane rarely goes anywhere without the car, we're more likely to make the error. If she sometimes takes the bus and sometimes is driven by a friend, we're less likely to make the error. Converse error 2. If I have the flu, then I have a sore throat. I have a sore throat. Therefore, I have the flu. But of course, there are possibilities other than P, flu, a cold or strep throat, for example. We're likely to make the error if people are dropping like flies from the flu, always with a sore throat as a symptom, and nothing much else is going around. We're much less likely to make the error if the flu, colds, and pollen allergies are all going around at once. Argument B earlier was, if died of cancer, then malignant tumor. Didn't die of cancer, therefore didn't have malignant tumor. This is called the inverse error. The form of this invalid argument is, if P then Q, not P therefore not Q. We make this error a lot too. Inverse error 1. If it's raining, then the streets must be wet. It's not raining, therefore the streets must not be wet. If we live in a city where the street sweepers operate frequently, thereby making the streets wet, or if it's a blazing summer day in a city where fire hydrants are sometimes open to cool people off, we're less likely to make the error. If we live in rural Arizona with no street sweepers and no fire hydrants, we're more likely to make the error. Inverse error 2. If President Obama is Muslim, then he's not a Christian. President Obama is not Muslim, therefore President Obama is a Christian. The conclusion would be valid if we had tacit knowledge operating as an additional premise to the effect that people can only be either Muslim or Christian. We don't believe that, of course, but we may have gotten into a mood of thinking these are the only alternatives for Obama. For example, if the only alternatives for Obama's religion ever discussed were Muslim and Christian. An interesting and important thing to know about the converse and inverse errors is that they are only deductively invalid conclusions. That is, they don't follow logically from their premises. They may, however, be pretty good inductive conclusions. That is, if the premises are true, the conclusion is more likely to be true. It's more likely that I have the flu if I have a sore throat than it is if I don't have a sore throat. If it's not raining, it's less likely that the streets are wet.